a lot of brewers in the front row.
Yes, you do. You brought some ringers.
If any easy questions come from up here, you'll...
Okay.
You know it's a setup.
Well, the man sitting to my left, obviously you know who he is. He is entering, this surprises me even to read it, his 10th season as chairman and principal owner of the Milwaukee Brewers. Brewers have qualified for the postseason twice during his tenure, and they are hoping to qualify for the postseason for a third time in 2014. The owner of the Milwaukee Brewers, Mark Attanasio.
Thank you for the nice introduction. I will point out, it's hard to believe it's 10 years. I mentioned last night, for folks interested in numerology, I bought the team in 05. 3 years later in 08, we made the playoffs. 3 years after that in 2011, we made the playoffs. And it is 3 years after that.
Here we go.
Now, the less well-known fact is that every year we play in Boston, we make the playoffs.
And this year?
And this year, we're the Red Sox opening day, Friday, April 4th, I think.
So. All right, there you go. Mark, let's start at the beginning. When did you first fall in love with baseball?
Oh, fell in love with baseball when I actually grew up in the Bronx, and my earliest recollections, I don't know when I first fell in love with baseball, but the 1964 season for the Yankees, I recall, and what I... to this day have a searing memory of was them losing to the Cardinals and leaving the apartment, which I probably shouldn't have done at the age of six or whatever, and walking around the block crying on Pelham Parkway in the Bronx because, you know, we had lost. And then kind of got back home, fortunately, and I thought, well, we'll win next year. And we were right about to, that's when the Yankees, you know, got old all of a sudden, about on the precipice of ushering in the Horace Clark era. And so, I think most folks who, you know, cheer for the Yankees had a different experience. My formative years with the Yankees were, you know, the better players were Horace Clark, Tom Tresh, Roy White. Not taking anything away from those players. But it wasn't exactly Mantle, Maris, Berra, you know.
Okay. Now, obviously, you go to Brown University, you go to Columbia Law School, and you go into money management and other aspects in that field. Why did you decide to buy a baseball team?
It's always been a passion, baseball. I was a really mediocre high school player, that's probably even stretching it a little bit, JV player. And now my cousins seem to recollect that when I was in law school that I said I wanted to buy a baseball team and that was a goal. It wasn't, you know, by the way, if it was a goal, that was really a crazy goal, right? But it's always been a passion of mine. I thought I would maybe have it, when I first got involved with the Brewers, I thought, well, gee, it'd be really neat to make a small investment in the commissioner's team, get known to the the folks in the sport over 20 years, and when I was ready to retire in my mid-60s, you know, maybe I could become a control owner of a team, who knows? And they then shifted to... Commissioner and his family shifted to doing a full sale of the team. And, you know, one of the things they taught us, mentioned I was money manager and investment banker. So when you bid on something, that's a non-binding indication of interest, which is pretty much every sports team. If you want it, what you need to do is put out a high number. If you put out a low number, they bounce you out of the process. And if the team ends up selling at that low number and you're out of the process, it's hard to go and say, well, gee, I would have paid that. There's a lot of that in sports. There's 122 sports teams, and there's probably 122,000 individuals who say, well, I would have paid that for that team. So I just put out I knew generally what number they wanted. A lot of folks were in the $150 to $180 million range at that time. So I said $200 million. And next thing you know, I'm in, and I see Bob Quinn and Rick Schlesinger sitting there, and they knew. Next thing I know, I'm in the finals with like three or four other bidders. And there you are. And so at that point, I thought, you know, when are you ever going to get an opportunity to buy a Major League Baseball team? You know, probably never. So better get it done.
Now, you spoke of your roots in New York. You've also lived in Los Angeles. Why Milwaukee? Was it just the one of 30 that was available?
My younger brother's wife is from Milwaukee, so I visited the community and was fond of it. And when I scratched the surface, you know, more than just visiting, it's really a wonderful community. And so, you know, it was a brand new. I remember very distinctly when I went out for my on-site diligence. I walked into the, and by the way, Allen and Company, who ran that process, they know how to run a sale of a sports team process, right? So they walk you into the right field corner, and there's this enormous structure, which is Miller Park. And you look up and you think, gosh, could you really own this? I mean, what would be cooler than this, right? And so that was that the second I stepped into the right field corner, which at that point, for everybody remembers Jeff Jenkins, had a big sign up that said Jenkins Jungle. And that was it. I was going to do everything I could to.
Now, how did you learn that you were the winning bidder?
So they had a very buttoned up process. So I think it's probably a function both of Allen and Company's process and Wendy Seelig, who ran the process, who lives in Arizona now, was also extremely disciplined. And they told me that they'd call me by 4 or 5 o'clock West Coast time, because they were having their board meeting and their vote. So I leave the office early, and I go and I sit in my study at home at like 4 o'clock. I'm ready, and you know. And there were a couple of other serious bidders. 5 o'clock, the phone doesn't ring. 6 o'clock, the phone doesn't ring. So I was getting a little uncomfortable, and I thought, you know, this may not be working out. I imagine they were talking to the other bidder. So I went downstairs. I have a small gym in my house, and I got on the treadmill and got rid of the anxiety. And in the course of getting rid of the anxiety, I was kind of preparing my concession speech, because again, it's the commissioner's team, and I wanted to be gracious, of course. So I had my whole concession speech planned. I go back upstairs, I sit in my office, and it's 7 o'clock, and the phone still hasn't rung. At least I have my speech ready now. So the phone finally rings, and it's Mark, Steve Greenberg, and Allen and Company. Hi, Steve, and he said. And then there's just silence, and I think Wendy was on the phone too. Wendy Seelig on the phone, complete silence. And I said, and he doesn't say anything, so I'm very uncomfortable. So I said, well, now I know how the Miss America candidate feels. and then Steve, who like completely deadpan, right on cue, says to me, we're not going to have any tears, are we? So yeah, I said, no tears. So he said, well, we have three questions to ask you. And I remember one of them was to bump the price a little bit. Now this, you know, relative to bidding process 101, the two points of advice I can give everyone is indicate at a high level, and second, if you're down to this final call and they say we have a few questions for you, the answer is always yes. Will you bump the price? Yes. Will you, I forgot, could you be, I don't remember the other two, I just remember the price. And then, when I said, I think he may have put price last, and then he says, oh, okay, you got it. I said, you know, I got it? He said, oh yeah, you got it, you're going to be the new owner of the Milwaukee Brewers. And I let out this scream that you could hear, you know, throughout my house, and poor Steve listened to all this. But I've never, you know, I think the only other time I can recall being that excited was when Carlos Gomez scored the winning run in the playoff round, and I kind of lost focus on what I was supposed to be doing as the owner, and I jumped over the wall and ran to home plate and jumped on him, which I still get teased about by the guys. But
okay, now, but getting to the part where now you're in baseball and you're going through the daily ups and downs, what was that like to adjust to? Because it is unlike any other business, and the people who work for teams, the people who are in the game, it's the thing that I guess they love the most and hate the most, just the highs and lows.
The thing that I talk to the players every year at the very start of spring training and at before the last road trip series, and one of the things you talk about is the fact that nothing else that I know of that you have to do at a very, even working on Broadway, you know, 162 games in 180 days. You need to go, and with that amount of travel, so even if you're on Broadway 6 days a week, you're kind of, you know, in one spot. Traveling all over the country, it's an enormous grind with huge highs and lows. And the best thing and the worst thing is that there's a game the next day, right? So if you're playing poorly, there's hope the next day, but also there's the grind of that. And it actually, you know, I had to draw my experience in the financial markets because, you know, we get a scorecard every day on the team, obviously winning and losing, and we in our, you know, on Wall Street, you know, the market's up, the market's down. If your portfolio is up, your portfolio is down. And if you look at any stock graph and it kind of goes like this, what you need is the trend. And so hopefully your trend is good in baseball. And so the first year was just a blur and awesome. And win or lose, you know, we'd be losing 12-2 and I'd be sitting there. And in fact, there was one day, it was an early season where I was sitting, you know, in Miller Park and it started raining and they didn't expect it. And so the roof, you know, wasn't closed. And I'm sitting there in the rain. For Cubs fans, I think we're losing 11-2 or something like that to the Cubs. And, you know, the players, I sit right next to the dugout and the players come out and they're even closer than, they're like where the stage is, the dais is here. And they never look at you, very rarely. Few guys look at Carlos Gomez will kind of look at you, but he's pretty amped up. But most of the guys won't look at you, it's like you're not there. So Jim Edmonds, who's a veteran, comes out to the on-deck circle and he looks over and he walks all the way over and he leans over to me and he says, "What are you still doing here?" And I'm like, "Well, we're playing, you know." He says, "It's raining." He didn't say we're losing, but yeah. Like looks at the scoreboard. So I learned how to moderate myself on the ups and downs. It's very, very hard to do because and folks who work for teams do it because they're passionate for the sport. The players are great at it. The players know, you know, they can turn within, you know, you go into a losing clubhouse as you have many times and it's quiet, but you know, 20 minutes, whatever, when it's done, they're in the dining room, you know, or the cafeteria eating and they're relaxed and, you know, they've learned mentally how to turn that off and all of us, you know, for 24 hours after a loss in the front office, grind our teeth till the next, you know, pitch comes, the first pitch. So
now, in 10 years as an owner, you've had one general manager, Doug Melvin, which is a little bit surprising. I don't know that there are many owners who could say that. I wonder, from day one to now, how has your relationship with him evolved?
Well, I'd say it's kind of like a marriage. And you know, you're a married man. I've been married 27 years. And, you know, as several of our presidents have told us, you have to work at a marriage. And, you know, you have to work at your relationship, which is a very close working relationship with all of these emotional ups and downs. You know, I felt as from a business side, if you look at well-run companies don't turn over their lead people. You know, they, you know, Microsoft went from Gates to Ballmer to the new guy over 30 years, you know. So I had a predisposition to, when you have a quality executive like we have in Doug, to, and I saw Jack Zirinczyk here, it's also a lot of pride for us that, you know, we incubated talent not only at the GM level, but future GMs. That you want to cherish that you have that, and you know, frankly, for the first, Doug probably wouldn't see it this way, but for the first 5 years, I feel like all I was doing was trying to take it in, and not that I didn't offer an opinion now and then, but one opinion I remember my first season, and I was really green, but I'm watching us on July 4th, and Who is the guy who is the former garbage collector who was Joe Winkle? It was Joe Winklesis. So we had that, and I'm not trying to pick on any, but we had Joe, and it was a great story because he'd been literally a garbage collector the year before. And it was a feel-good story, and we're going to be a mop-up guy. And again, I'm new to the sport, so I didn't think mop-up meant, you know, tie game, full house in Miller Park, July 4th, bases loaded for Washington, Alfonso Soriano coming up, and we bring in Joe Winklesass. So, and I don't do this anymore. So I'm watching this. I wasn't at the game. I was home. So I called Doug. He's in his suite. I said, Doug, we're bringing in Joe Winklesass to face Alfonso Soriano with the bases loaded. And just as he's about to say something, grand slam. He just launches it.
Well, it was a good question.
I think the answer is the manager doesn't. You know, what's interesting is the GMs. GMs generally have a plan, and I know in Moneyball, you see with Billy Bean how there's a lot of at least if as represented dialogue between the GM and the manager. Doug has an absolute plan for all of these guys, but he really, having been around baseball for so long, has I think learned that from at least from his standpoint. Letting the managers work through some of this stuff is better than his. So he really actually goes down to the clubhouse. So that I think he may have told our manager, who was Ned Yost at that time, after the game, you know, that wasn't really what we were hiring Joe for. But, you know, Earl Weaver used to say, if a guy's wearing a major league uniform, I'm going to put him out there. And so sometimes what the GMs have to do is they'll actually realize that if they don't like the way a manager is using a player, you know, it's easier to just move the player, which I think we also saw in the Moneyball movie with the A's.
Now, over the years, there have been times where you have been hands-on, maybe more hands-on than most owners. And I'm curious, when do you know or when do you feel it's the proper time for you to exert more influence than you otherwise might?
I don't know that you ever know when the right time is, you know. And I was saying last night to a couple of our colleagues that I've been in the sport now coming on 10 years, I worry sometimes that, you know, I'm getting too much bounded by convention now. A lot of that, whenever I, you know, would insert myself into a process a little bit, was a function of two things. It was passion, and in some cases it was, you know, I was... naive is maybe a tough word, but I was too inexperienced to know better, but it turned out to be the right move. And so now I worry that because I have, you know, experience to draw on and I'm more patient, I don't know if Doug would think I'm more patient, but I think I'm more patient, I don't insert myself the way I might have before. So, you don't really know, but you do, you know, the... One of the nice things you asked about working with Doug, one of the things he told me from the very beginning, back to when he was with the Orioles working for Peter Angelos, that he feels like, you know, the owner is like a factory owner. If the factory owner wants to put a new machine in, or, you know, it's his business. How can you, he can, the GM who's maybe running the factory can give you his thoughts, but if you want to do something, it's, you know, he's always... been supportive of that, or certainly whether he, and in most cases actually he's agreed with what I wanted to do, but he's supportive of the owner coming in and you know doing something.
Now the last 2 years, the last two off seasons, you guys have signed a starting pitcher late. Obviously, all teams work with a budget, and yet from the outside it appears the owner just decided he wanted the player. So can you talk first about Loesch? And then about Garza, and how those decisions came about, and how you made it work financially.
Well, we actually, teams do have a budget, but we, in some sense, haven't. Back to 2009, we used to have very rigid budgets, and I think it was the 09 season, we ended up, and again, I don't, know, it's entertaining, and everybody here loves baseball, but I don't want to be in any way, you know, it is so hard to be a major league player. I don't care if you throw one pitch. I'm totally respectful of it. But, you know, that year, because we're fitting in a budget, we had four average pitchers. And I remember, Doug, which was clever. He's very, you know, he's got a good sense of humor. So that year he was telling the media that, four of a kind beats two aces. Well, we found out that year that four of a kind may beat two aces in poker. It does not beat two aces in baseball. And one of our guys gave up the most home runs in the league, and it was one of those years. So this is with experience in the sport, I determined that it was more important to have players who were difference makers. I mean, you need depth, but players who you're better off to use depth with young players and players who are difference makers. So, in each case, so the budget was kind of there, but there's always, you know, we've run the team financially responsibly for a while now, so that, you know, we can't always stretch the budget the way a large market team can, but we can stretch the budget to find a player, whether it's through trade or when we stretched the budget when we traded for Zach Greinke. But you know, it gets more attention in terms of your budget when you sign a free agent. So, you know, there was this in my investment business, I focus on opportunity, and usually the best times to be a buyer in the markets is when there's either fear or nobody else is buying, and usually they're connected, but. And so what happened with Kyle was, it was the new CBA, you had this rule about giving up a draft choice, and giving up the draft choice quickly evolved in our sport, and somewhat to this day, though it's changing a little bit, from giving up a lottery ticket to like giving up your firstborn. You know, just GMs were not going to give up that draft choice. Didn't matter. And we'd sit there, and it's an analytics conference. You know, you can actually do some work and say, well, what are the odds of a number 17 pick, you had the 17 pick that year, making it to the big leagues? What are the odds of it, that pick being a six-year big leaguer, which is about 5%? And what's the impact that's going to have on you? Now it's a little more nuanced because your farm system is currency for trades and things. If we didn't have a good farm system, we couldn't have traded for Zach Greinke. So it's not as binary as that, which is some of the challenges with analytics, I think. Generally, whether you look at them for baseball, you look at it for making an investment, people want to get to a binary, you know, if it's this, then it's that, and it's usually more complicated. So we were also making a decision to not restock our farm system, which needed some restocking. So you look at that, and then you look at what kind of a discount you think you're getting off in a normal market. Kyle Loesch would have commanded after being 16-3. And then the final overlay on that, and you ask, well, how did it come about, is I came down to Arizona here. We did a tour of the Dodgers and White Sox stadium to see we're at Maryvale, which the best thing about Maryvale is that it's really quaint and it's really old school. And Ken's smiling because he's been to Maryvale. We'd invite everyone to come out to Maryvale. It's a throwback, but not in the way that, you know, Wrigley Field is a throwback. It needs some capital spending. So I was looking at the Dodgers ballpark, and you talk about passion and where I am in emotion. And our game, we played the White Sox that day, and our guys just got smoked. I mean, balls were rocking. You know, I thought there were going to be dents in the wall. It was brutal. And I met with Doug. I said, Doug, I'm going to have to go. We've got to get one of these pitchers. We just can't go through a season like this because, you know, away from competing and trying to win, I think there's also, and everybody here, we all love the sport, and what's great about the sport is, you know, there's hope. And you know, to spend a summer, and folks in Wisconsin look forward to spending their summers. There's nothing nicer than spending a summer day at Miller Park. But if you know that there's just no chance you're going to win, or worst case, you're going to continue to see bad baseball, that is not okay with me. And I was very concerned about, I wasn't kidding myself to think, oh boy, we get Kyle Loesch and it's going to change things. But I just had to bring the quality of the product we were giving to our fan base up. And you know, I it's interesting because when the deal was first announced, everyone looked at it as a bad deal because we gave up the draft choice. And when you roll through, now folks are mostly writing about it like it was a good deal, which it was. And Kyle's great in any event. We, you know, also looking to build a clubhouse. So it's kind of a long inside baseball story, but that's how that
kind of evolved.
So Matt was different. Matt, you know, we're focusing on pitching in depth. And in between, you know, we've quietly done some things to, very quietly, to build our farm system and pitching. So last year we got a pitcher who was a high school pitcher, Williams, I think, in the, you know, late in the number 40, number 50 with the pick we had. And he really projected higher. And our scouts and development people did a great job getting him in. And I think he's already considered one of our top five prospects. And then when we traded John Axford, we got Michael Blazek, who was a very, you know, live arm. And this offseason, I have this Taiwanese pitcher, Wong, who, you know, this kid just throw, you know, last year he just throws strikes. He's 21 years old, and he's a very high ceiling. And we're going to try to figure out how to keep him on our, you know, roster this year. They haven't made any decisions on that. But so, you know, just in terms of restocking the farm system, we trade K-Rod, we get a player, Delmonico's, a lefty hitting third baseman from the Orioles, and then we get K-Rod back. So we're, you know, and again, we're, you know, small market team, or I call ourselves a mid-market team in the Midwest. And, but, you know, Doug and his group quietly get five guys in to the farm system in a very, you know, high caliber way. And then we trade for Will Smith from the Royals, another pitcher. So I was looking at this and thinking, well, you know, how can we get better? And, you know, Nez Bilillo, who's Ryan Braun's agent, and I were talking in California, and actually was at Ryan's wedding, and he was talking about one of his players maybe could come into our bullpen, and you know, the price was high for us for how we were looking to construct our bullpen, and so it wasn't going to work. And so I started walking away, and he said, "I said, well, anybody else?" I literally started walking away, and out of this side, it is my bad ears, I was telling Ken. He said, "Well, how about Matt Garza?" So I swivel around and I spin around. I say, "Well, how about Matt Garza?" He said, "Well, you know," and he told me generically what kind of situation Matt was looking for. Well, Renicky's there. So I walk over like to where the projector is, sit down at Ron's table. I said, "Ron, how about Matt Garza?" he goes, "Yeah." So the next morning I called Doug and I said, "Well, how about Matt Garza?" And, you know, first thing was, well, you know, isn't he too expensive? Because, you know, some of what happens in this, and there's been a lot of commentary around the Irvin Santana thing, I think numbers get leaked around players. And sometimes they're accurate and sometimes they're not. But where they're not accurate, I think it dampens the market. So, you know, the numbers on Matt that were, some of them were $75, $80 million. Which we, you know, the Milwaukee Brewers, it's very hard for us to do that for a pitcher, only because, you know, pitching is so, one pitch, it could hurt your arm and all that. So as we got into the conversation, which then went, so this was early December all the way through, it was a whole process. When we make a decision at the team on baseball, I think this is probably true for a lot of teams, but, you know, I counted when we did the Grinke trade, I think we had 14 or 16 people, probably everybody sitting in the front row here, worked on that in some way, including, by the way, Craig Counsell went out, you know, because, you know, there was some rumors, can Segura play shortstop? He's really a second baseman. So when Craig Counsell goes out and comes back and says, He can play shortstop, which we now all know. But that's a pretty good, you know, point of view. We had analytics people, we had scouts, we had, you know, and then the senior people. We have 16 people part of it. Likewise with Matt, we had, and never counted to that extent, but we had huge number of, it had to be 10 or 12 people at our group. You know, we went out and diligenced him. Ron, you know, one of the nice things about having Ron as a manager is he's got, and Doug as a general manager, both have a lot of relationships with baseball because they're just, they're good guys. So we can get good information. And, you know, the information that came back on Matt is that he was a good guy. You know, all the managers who he had pitched for liked having him. You know, we had, you know, we had Madden at the Rays, and we had Dale Swaim, who had worked for us in the Cubs, and somehow we got to the Twins, who were also looking at him, so that was a little tougher. But, you know, we were able to get, you know, a good picture. And it took probably 2 months at that point, or upwards. So some of it was, some of it relative to timing, and that was situational, how much time it took us to do the work. And then some of it, I think if you look at free agency over the last several years, and again from an analytics standpoint, there are better deals to be had. The later you go into the free agent, the Rays have been, you know, brilliant at this actually. You know, they do a bunch of January signs, and they're all good signs. What you can't do with that is, you know, if you want a particular player, you know, if you have, and especially if it's a marquee, you know, Jack was here. Jack wasn't going to wait till Robinson Cano was not going to go at a bargain basement price in January. So you can't do that. But if you say, look, you're willing to hang back and wait, and if you get nothing, you're okay. We really were comfortable with our pitching this year. We've got 20 guys for 12 spots who have played well, or pitched well at the major league level. So, but he, you know, it changed the whole dynamic, we feel.
Now, you mentioned Nez Bolello. He works for CAA. He is Braun's agent. He is Garza's agent. He's also Aoki's agent. And you guys, from what I can tell from the outside, are fairly friendly. So does that occasionally lead to deals like at Braun's wedding? But also in the case of Aoki, how did that
happen? By the way, that was really unique. One of the things I feel is the more you get out and connect and talk to people, the more, and maybe this is some of my, you know, background more in banking. You know, had I not been, you know, he actually had not called me on Matt.
Right.
You know, it just came up in this conversation on a completely different player. I think as I have a good relationship with Scott Boras too, who's Kyle's agent, and through the course of talking to Scott, you know, that, you know, Scott told me, by the way, on Kyle, I set a record, the prior record, I don't remember who the player was, the prior record was with John Mosliak and the Cardinals. He had to make like 19 phone calls to get him to say yes, and he made 31 or 33 phone calls to me. We had 33 conversations on Kyle. So I think that defines persistence. I think that there's a, and Doug is a terrific relation. I think we're perceived as a user-friendly team, you know, from the agency, from agent side.
One more question before we take questions.
Sure, great.
The broadcast revenue challenge that you guys face, that most mid to low revenue teams face. Your deal is locked in, as far as I can tell, and yet it's going to be dwarfed by other deals. How do you make it work?
Well, our deal's locked in until 2020. At that time, we made a shorter term, quote, shorter term extension of 8 years. I wanted to do as short as we could. Fox wanted to do as long as they think they, what did they want, 20 years? Something like that, when we extended for 8, but whatever we had done, because we're, you know, it's Wisconsin against the world here. We've got, you know, Minnesota and Chicago and Illinois and Detroit. It's whatever we can sell in Wisconsin. It's one of the reasons these CBA negotiations are so important. And, you know, Commissioner Selig and the negotiating team last time, it was Artie Moreno and, you know, Jerry Reinsdorf, or I think Jerry was the lead, but you know, you're trying to vector to competitive balance. It's critical. And, you know, we've had, notwithstanding this disparity in broadcast revenues, we've had terrific competitive balance. I think it's one of the reasons you have a full room here, because it's interesting that there's, you know, we calculate this year that 17 teams have their highest payrolls ever. And, you know, that includes, and I bothered to write this down, the, you know, us, the A's, the Rays, the Padres, Baltimore, Colorado, you know, a lot of very, very few, the Dodgers are an outlier in Philadelphia, but Pittsburgh, so that's all, you know, working. And we need to figure out how to compete against that backdrop. It's an increasing challenge, there's no doubt.
Okay. Questions?
No questions.
No, there's questions. Here we go.
So revenue sharing, that's a, you know, a big point in baseball. If you can comment about your thoughts about the revenue sharing in baseball and maybe some changes you'd like to see implemented, or if you like the system the way it is now.
Well, I think the system always, you know, the system has worked now, you know, and I think by definition it's worked because you have, you know, labor peace, and you have to start with that because the sport is the national pastime, right? So you need to have baseball games being played in the summer. Nobody wants to, you know, have a work stoppage. I think on either side, no matter however either side postures. You know, ball players want to play baseball, and we want to, you know, we all want to, you know, it's really fun, right? I can't imagine a summer without baseball. So, although I guess there was one once.
Yeah.
So, but you need to do it, it needs to be calibrated in a way so that, you know, last year, and it wasn't us, so last year, the Pittsburgh story was a great story. I mean, that was, you know, you want that hope wherever it is, so you have to fine-tune it. And, you know, like I'm saying in looking at statistics, I think sometimes some of the challenges, if you pick on any one point in the CBA, so what's coming up now is this draft choice thing. And there's some, you know, there's maybe some unexpected results out of that plan. But the whole of the CBA as it was constructed, which not only included that, but included you know, sandwich picks for lower revenue teams, or smaller market teams as defined, you know, includes slotting and other allowance. As a whole, it works. So what I think we have to be, you know, aware of in any negotiation, including on revenue sharing, it's really two negotiations, right? You have the negotiation and revenue sharing among the teams, and you have the discussion with the players on how to, because I view that as revenue sharing too. We're right around 52% of our total revenues go in terms of player compensation. And, you know, it has to work. It has to work. Likewise, well, I've talked a lot about the small market teams here. Obviously, from our perspective, we want to be able to compete. I think the large market teams need to have the benefit of their bargain that they, you know, they run a, you know, they run a business, and they, you know, they all, for the most part anyway, spend a lot of money in terms of delivering quality product to their fans, and you know, there's a limit on how much they should be asked to give up, and those of us who receive the money need to be using it to put a competitive product on the field and not to put money in our pockets. So it ends up being a multi-layered conversation.
Hi, Mark. Mike Velsich, University of Chicago. Thanks for coming out. I had a question for you about how you think about the overall Brewers business profitability and revenue, how that intersects with projections you have for your team to make the playoffs. And, you know, for instance, if you think that going into a year you might win, you know, 86 or 87 win games, but one or two players you sign could put you into a, you know, 90 win plus category, and you feel pretty good about making the playoffs. How much might that uplift on the business side from additional revenue from making the playoffs impact your ability to, you know, pay for a player that on the margin could get you into that category?
Well, it impacts it a lot, but you can't project it. You know, last year we couldn't have projected all the injuries we have. The sport, in a sense, is somewhat seasonal the way retail business is seasonal. Retail business, you got to do well at Christmas to have a good selling season or a good year. In baseball, if you have a tough start, you know, which, by the way, we had last year in May in the perfect storm of negative events. Not only do we have all the injuries, we only won six games in May. The last time we'd only won six games was in 1969 in a month when, in August, I believe, when the Milwaukee Brewers were the Seattle Pilots. And so what happens is when you have a month like that, all the air comes out of the balloon. And especially in a community like ours where we, more so than other teams in our community, there's a lot of walk-ups for people who buy tickets, you know, same day. And so, you know, any of our projections last year, which were, you know, we, and again, this is an analytics conference, so you know, Bob Quinn is sitting in the front row here. We had 10 years of data looking backwards that we could have told you there's no way we would have only drawn 2.56 million fans last year, but we never would have projected those outlier assumptions. And so it's very hard to therefore project, but what you try to do is come up with a baseline, and you don't want to get into, you can move in a sport, in this sport, by the way, even for our team, we can be plus or minus $30 million if you factor everything in. And so if you can't absorb that, you shouldn't. And that's where you see teams running into trouble if they either can't, they budget in any way and they can't absorb it. Oftentimes then you'll see, you know, wholesale trades of players. Or if teams are just too nervous about it and they can't absorb it, where they're just very disciplined then in not increasing and keeping to a budget. So you can't, and then of course you have to, like at least in our team, if we're in the hunt in the summer and there's a trade deadline, there is no budget. That's like we've got CeCe. There, you know, that we are in it to win it. So.
Hey, Mark. I was in Milwaukee over the past summer in August, as you were alluding to, when the Brewers decided to give $10 ticket vouchers to each fan who came to the ballpark in August. Can you sort of discuss the decision-making process that you and your personnel had to make to sort of implement that program for the fans?
We'd actually, and you know, the business people are in the front row here, Rick Schlesinger, Bob Quinn, Teddy Werner. Tom Hecht is here, runs sponsorships from a business side, but he wasn't part of the decision, the other guys were. It was such, our fans, you know, every owner says their fans are the best in baseball, and I say it and I believe it, our fans are just awesome. And they kept coming out to games last year, you know, even with all the injuries, you know, even with the six wins in a month. So we started a conversation about what we could do, and I like to think outside the box on what we can do. My first year, our last game of the season was actually on my birthday, as it turned out, so I thought I'd give the fans a birthday present for me, and I just gave out free tickets to a game the next year, which sometimes got some mixed reviews in the sports, and I'm supposed to be giving away games worth of free tickets, but I wanted to do something different. So we went around on things, and then we had a situation where Ryan Braun got, you know, suspended. So it was, you know, talk about a perfect storm after all that. So look, we just got to do something really different, and so it was literally, you know, saying here's a voucher. We appreciate that you all come out. You can do whatever you want with it. And then, of course, you know, folks looked and said, well, what's the catch? Well, there was no catch. So the night we gave out the vouchers, and I didn't think about it like this, but I had a guy with, like, full of, you know, armful of food saying, thanks for feeding my family. I had a woman come up to me with these two enormous drinks, said, thanks for the drinks. People were buying tickets. People were buying T-shirts. The only thing that was, the only people who weren't smiling is Bob and Joe Zdanek, who was our financial person. We had we had folks from the front office giving out the vouchers, and it was like giving out $10 bills or 20, whatever. The vouchers, $10? Like, and they were not smiling as they were handing them out. But it was a group decision. We do a lot of things collectively like that.
Hey, let me jump in. You mentioned Braun, and the journalist in me, I can't help but.
I was thinking, Kyle, we got through the interview without Ryan.
All right. Two years ago, the press conference at Maryvale, we all heard what Ryan said. And I am sure you had conversations with him in private in which he expressed similar thoughts. You're the owner of the team. You've made this monstrous investment in him. You've made him your guy. What was your reaction when you heard that essentially he had lied to you?
Well, first I was just, you know, as everyone was, I was just forgetting about that. That's kind of the second wave is, oh, he lied to me. The first wave is I was just stunned that he had done that. Forget about that he had lied about it and had the press conference. Just I was stunned he had done it for a lot of reasons. And then it sank in. So I had him come over to my apartment in Milwaukee, and we had a private meeting for an hour and expressed how I felt about that. But once I did that, and you know, he committed to me that he was going to do everything he could to win back, you know, my trust, the trust of the, more importantly, the trust of the fans and the community. You know, you need when you own a baseball team is a public trust, and so I ultimately needed to do the right thing here. But the right thing I felt was to give him the opportunity to win back everyone's trust. And also, from running, you know, the guy is a really good player, you know? And so there was even an editorial in the local paper, well, run him out of town. Well, you know, MVPs don't come through Milwaukee that often, so you can't just run someone out of town because I'm having a, you know, I'm going to be petulant about someone not telling me the truth. So we're working through it, and he's, you know, he's in the second inning of the game here, as far as I'm concerned, or third inning. But he's done, you know, a lot of good things in the community since, you know, he's come forth. He made a terrible mistake at the age of 28. I'm not making excuses for Ryan here, but. You know, people make bigger mistakes who are more mature. So I and America is founded on giving folks a second chance. But he needs to make the most of the second chance, and he knows that.
Okay. Next question. Any more?
Over here. It's Ray Petrus, private practice, sports psych, and. Pain and injury. And I just want to make a comment, Mr. Antanasio. A couple of years ago, I was over at Maryvale, so I've been to the quaint place, and he was standing there, and I had a chance to walk up to him and talk to him, and I just wanted to relay the information that I never felt more comfortable and more at ease with anybody than I did with him. So I think that's a bode for him and his team and his corporation, and I just... And I have a question. I just wanted to say that because I thought that was just so amazing. And I still feel that to this day, that it was just so comfortable. So thank you.
Well, thank you. That's very nice to hear.
Anybody else? In the back.
Thank you. Somewhat of a delicate question about why you decided to buy a team and get into baseball, your love of the game versus the P&L financial aspects. And I guess what triggers this question is that there was an article written over the fall without naming the team and without naming the owner. I guess you as an owner, you get to keep in your market all of your ticket sales, your merchandise sales, all of the sponsorships, that sort of thing. But when it comes to things such as merchandising around the league, there is a big pool that you all share in. And from what I understand, this owner came out with the comment that, you know something, I am not in a primary market, I share in this great big merchandise pool. Why should I field a team with tens of millions of dollars of overhead when I have the ability to run this as a successful P&L operation? Mm-hmm. Obviously, the fan base was in an uproar, and I'd just like to get your comments on that, please.
Well, let's just start by saying that your recitation of how it works is accurate. And, I mean, in terms of the how the money flows, and one of the ways I got comfort, because it was a big investment. In fact, so after I got done with all the euphoria, what I didn't say is my wife, Debbie, came into the study, and she kind of closed the door, and she said, "You're not going to lose all our money, are you?" And she's 5'4", but she can be pretty scary. 5'4", 105 pounds, and she can be pretty scary. So I said, "Well, no, hon, I'm not that, you know, I'm not that."
I said that I'm an investor.
I don't, you know, that's not the idea. I got a lot of comfort when, and the numbers would be different for us now because as we built up the business, it skews lower. But when the team, you know, hadn't, you know, Tom Hecht, who's in the front row, I hadn't mentioned, done a great job with sponsorships for us, and you know, media has improved, and Jill Aronoff, who I saw this morning, has done a great job on retail. So our numbers are now up. We were in the bottom, you know, 10% of revenues at one point in the sport. We're not at all there now. But when we were in the bottom quartile, let's call it, 40% of our revenues came from a shared revenue source, which would have been either revenue, when I first bought the team, whether it was revenue sharing then or, you know, and that, if I believe if you buy a t-shirt from a team on MLB.com that's not yours, you know, everybody shares, you know, 1/30. So if there's...
So Tanaka is good for the Brewers.
Yeah, Tanaka is good, yes. Tanaka is good for baseball. Tanaka is good for the Yankees, and he's good for baseball. He's good, yeah, if they sell Tanaka t-shirts, if something gets sold on MLB.com, it comes... So I felt that the investment was 40% of the revenue is coming from a shared source. It was almost as much an investment in Major League Baseball as it was in the Milwaukee franchise. And I think to this day, for the bottom rung metrics, again, we've moved out of that bottom rung, but through the great job people have done here, but that's probably the case. Now, owners get to do what they want with their resources. And so, you know, for me, I'm doing this for passion. I think it's probably evident. July 4th phone calls on Soriano Grand Slams, but you know, for others it may have a different motivation. I've continued to work in my money management business, I call it my day job, so that I can pour every penny that we make at the team and then some back into the franchise, whether it's players, it's every year we've improved the ballpark. You know, I can't speak for other owners who, you know, run it differently. If you the sport is healthy, and you know, one of the great things with Commissioner Seelig has built the sport is healthy, so that, you know, you can make a profit in baseball if you want to make a profit. And that wasn't always true in baseball. And varying points, it wasn't true in other leagues, but it's true in baseball. And so, it's I don't know which owner you're talking about, but looks like Ken does.
All right, that will wrap it up. I want to thank Mark very much for coming out. Appreciate it.